Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Of Slippers and Spindles. I'm Cassie.
And I'm Drew. Welcome back. Cassie, we're at the end of Rapunzel month.
I know, and it means we're also at the end of November, which is the end of NaNoWriMo. Yeah, so lots been going on this month. I want to give, like, just a huge shout out to my writing kids at the library, and they don't listen to this, but that's okay. I had four kids join me on the NaNoWriMo adventure this month, and I've been trying to start a writing group at my library forever, and I've never been able to make it stick. But my kids told me today that they don't want to stop when November stops, and they want to know where else we can go on the internet to give them an interface like the NaNo website. Wow. So that they can keep tracking their daily writing goal. Like, they want to keep doing it. And I'm so excited.
That is so amazing. That's amazing.
Because, like, I was not that disciplined with writing when neither. I was 13.
Like, but I think maybe if I had something like NaNoWriMo, especially if I was doing it with other kids my age, you know, maybe I would have been.
Yeah. So I'm really excited.
That's amazing.
We're recording this about halfway through November, so hopefully by the time it drops...
Timelines are a lie.
Hopefully by the time it drops, I will have solved this issue already, but I've got to go do some research into what online platforms there are that
there's
I can
gotta
make
be something.
Function like. Because what they like about the NaNo website is that they get the graph, and it, like, shows them their progress towards their goal. And I don't know if I can recreate that exactly, but I've got to find a place where I can do something.
There's got to be something.
Similar enough. There's got to be something. So I'm gonna look into it.
Yeah.
See what I can find. But I'm really excited. These four kids, they're 11, 12, and 13. And some of them have, like, pretty small writing goals where they're only challenging themselves to write 250 words a day. So their total for the month would be like 7,500, but still, like,
you know what? That's more than I wrote. So
I know
they did better than me.
I mean, my daily goal this whole year has been 100 words a day. So
listen, anything counts. Just get the words
anything
on the page.
Everything counts. And they're always so excited to talk about their stories. And I'm always, every week I go into it saying, all right, so has anybody been having any trouble, been running into some writer's block? And they're like, nope, let me tell you about this whole thing I wrote this week.
Oh my gosh, that's so cute. Oh,
fantastic.
I'm so proud. I don't even know them, but I'm so proud of them.
I'm very excited. I've got one kid who very much plans everything out in advance. And I've got one kid who just sits down and writes and sees what happens.
That is amazing to me. I am very much a plotter. People who write just flying by the seats of their pants amaze me, but in a way that is, like, scary to me. Like, I'm less impressed and more just terrified of you.
Exactly. It's like, how do you write without knowing where your story's going?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
That's so intimidating.
Yeah, they also all want to read the novel that I'm working on right now.
As they should, because it's very, very good.
Oh, it needs so much editing, but thank you.
I don't even care.
I know you don't. But yeah, so that's my exciting news. I'm coming home from the kind of the glow of that, because it's the last thing I do on Mondays before I come home is I go and I work with them. And so it's always a lot of fun to leave those sessions. And I'm very proud of them. So see? Anybody can be a writer.
That's right. That's right. My only big news this week is I'm about to go on a vacation, and I'm very excited because outside of, well, obviously I was furloughed at the beginning of the year, like many of us were, but I don't count that as a vacation. So outside of that, the only vacations I've taken for the last 2 years have either been for family weddings or family funerals. And so I am about to take some well-deserved rest, and I'm going to be reading up on some Beauty and the Beast books to get ready for our December month.
That is super exciting. But before we can get to Beauty and the Beast, we need to wrap up Rapunzel.
Yes, we do. That's right. Our last discussion of Rapunzel. So here's where I'd like to start with our discussion of Rapunzel today. Okay?
Absolutely.
What is up with Rapunzel's birthday? Every single story we looked at this month used Rapunzel's birthday as, like, this central part of the story. Did you notice this?
I definitely noticed it on a couple.
It's all of them. So Grounded starts right before her birthday. She does end up sleeping through her birthday in the Fairy Glade, but it does start right before her birthday. She makes a big fuss about it. And then Rapunzel's Revenge, she's 12 years old. It's on her 12th birthday that she first climbs the wall and sees the outside world. And then her birthday is when Mother Gothel comes to visit her in like the tree tower every year. And then Zell also starts right before her birthday. And her birthday is a big deal because it signifies the connection between her and Conrad, because they share a birthday and Conrad's mother is a big believer in astrology and all that kind of stuff. So that's a big part there. And then Tangled, obviously, is all about the lanterns on her birthday and her going to see those lanterns. And that's how she figures out who she is. Every Rapunzel revolves around her birthday.
I mean, I can see it. Birthdays are like a storytelling touchstone because it's it's like an anchor in your life.
Yeah, and I think especially for a girl who's locked in a tower and has no sense of what's happening in the world, like, I'm sure she sees the seasons pass, but like, you know, she doesn't have a calendar or anything. And so probably the one consistent thing in her year is that that birthday.
Yeah, so I can see it, especially for Rapunzel. I can see why you would make her birthday a centerpiece, especially because her birth is what launches the whole story. Yes. She's born and then she's kidnapped. And so, like, that's kind of a turning point in the narrative of the fairy tale itself. And so it makes sense to use that from a storytelling standpoint, from a literary standpoint, it makes sense to build that parallel into what you're telling. So yeah, I think it makes sense. I hadn't noticed it until you pointed it out, but yeah.
Yeah. That's my first observation that I have taken from this month. What about you? Okay. What's something that you took away from our Rapunzel month?
Apparently, Rapunzel has a lot in common with Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yes.
And so that's a popular choice to kind of put the two of them together. It makes sense. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the month about Jack climbs things. And so it kind of makes sense to pair him with the girl in the tower. But I was also struck by the fact that of the four versions of Rapunzel we looked at, three of them use the major events of the story as like an anchor and then send Rapunzel off on a different adventure that's not connected to the original fairy tale at all.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. And again, I understand it because when you're writing a story about a girl who spends most of her life in a tower and you want to expand that story, if she just stays in the tower, it's harder to make it interesting and engaging. So sending her off on an adventure not only gives her more agency, it can be a more interesting story. Zell, of course, is the one book that didn't do that. And I think Zell is a very engaging story. I think Donna Jo Napoli handles sticking closer to the original text very well.
Yes. And she's also the only one that we looked at this month that looks at Rapunzel from multiple perspectives. So I think maybe if you read Zell and you only read Zell's chapters, maybe not quite as engaging, but because she loops in Conrad and Mother, that really fleshes out the full story. Whereas the other three, the three that go off on their own adventures, are pretty much only being told from Rapunzel's perspective.
Yeah. And I think you definitely look at Rapunzel would have lived a pretty boring life in her tower. And so if we're going to tell a story about her, we've got to give her something else to do.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
So, yeah, I liked all of the tellings that we looked at this month. There weren't
Me
any
too.
Where I was like, ooh, this is not well done. I enjoyed all of them. And yeah, I think it's really interesting to see how prominent the deviations were, the choice to deviate from the narrative. I'd be interested to read some more and look at some more that stick a little closer to the text and see how that is handled.
Yeah, I would be very interested to read some more Rapunzels. This is definitely a fairy tale that I would like to return to someday, because I think we could see how widely these stories varied. You know, they share those common roots of the beginning and sometimes the end, but there's so much space to fill in the middle that there's so many different ways that I think you could fill up that space.
Yeah. I'm also interested in the way that this idea of Rapunzel's innocence comes into play in a lot of the versions that we looked at. It's kind of a recurring theme. So in Grounded, her innocence is what gives Enviaria her power. In Zell, she needs to stay unattached to the world and ignorant of the world so that she can make this choice that Mother made. And in Tangled, it's not so much a plot point as just like an aspect of her character because she's been in the tower her whole life. She has this kind of innocence and purity about her. And I think the same can be true depending on the slant you look at Rapunzel's revenge in.
Because yeah, I think she, you could slot
she hasn't there. Been weighed down by the cynicism of the world she lives in.
Yeah.
So she's still like an idealist. And so I think that it's interesting to see how those qualities contribute, that idea of innocence contributes to Rapunzel's personality in each version. She's very much an optimist. She's very much pure of heart. She's very much idealistic, naive in some cases. And it's interesting to see how that plays out in the story based on the circumstances of the world that was created to house this story.
Yeah. And off of that, it's interesting that Rapunzel, I think, was really well used to explore the world because she's a character who has not experienced these worlds. So we really especially see this in Grounded, where we're introduced to the world of time through Rapunzel. And then also, I think, in Rapunzel's Revenge is the other big one that uses Rapunzel's lack of knowledge of the outside world to then introduce the reader to the outside world. I think Tangled does this a little bit as well. Zell, not so much, just because the circumstances and the storyline are different. But I think that's just a really clever thing to do when you're trying to set up a full world for your new reader.
Right. And I think Zell doesn't do it as much because Zell is set in the real world.
Yes, yes, of course.
There's not magic, but it's set in Switzerland. So
there's not a world we're being introduced to. Yeah.
We're being introduced to 1500 Switzerland.
Yeah.
So our standing question for you as a writer, have you tackled a rewrite of Rapunzel? Do you have an idea for how you would handle it?
So I have not written Rapunzel yet. I have ideas of what I would do with Rapunzel, but they're kind of just seeds of ideas and how I would change the story. Like, I have this idea of the father refusing to go get the Rapunzel lettuce, and so the mother has to go get it herself, and she's the one who meets the witch, and so what happens there? I think the story could go off in some interesting directions, but I don't have like a grand retelling idea. What about you? What's your Rapunzel idea?
I have not tackled this one either.
Yeah.
Even to the extent in my giant fairy tale mashup, we don't actually meet Rapunzel because the character I focus on from her story is the witch.
Right.
And the way that I get around the Rapunzel story in that is Rapunzel's mother, when she's pregnant and she has the cravings, like goes to the witch and says, "Hi, I'm pregnant and I'm having these cravings. Can I have some vegetables from your garden?" So she like goes and makes friends with the witch so that that whole storyline is negated. But I have some, again, some seeds of an idea like you for how to modernize the story, because I'd be I'm really interested in how the story modernizes, because most people don't do that. This all stems from in college I babysat a girl named Kale, and me being who I am, I met this three-year-old and I was like, you know, modern day Rapunzel would be named Kale.
Oh my gosh, she would. Right?
Yeah. So
Okay, I like that.
So then I was like, okay, and I really want to play around with the perceptions in this story. And so I am interested in looking at it as Kale, the modern day Rapunzel, thinks of herself as the prisoner in the tower, held captive by her mother who doesn't understand who she is and is overprotective. But that's not actually the reality of what's happening. And so playing around with that, like, she's adopted. I haven't figured out the exact circumstances, but I want it to be something like a thief breaks in to Mother Gothel's house because his girlfriend is pregnant and he needs to steal things for money. And he confesses to her that neither he nor his girlfriend really want the baby. And since she does want a child, she offers to, like, I'll pay for all the hospital bills. I'll adopt your child, basically.
Wow.
And so then it's just like the pushback of this 16-year-old girl rebelling against her mother and the unfairness that she feels is part of her situation. And she climbs out the window at night to go off with a bad crowd. Like, things like that.
I really like this.
So, like, that's kind of – I don't have a lot of stuff planned out for it. I want to work the pregnancy in.
Yeah.
To kind of bring that back to the original story, and look at how in a modern context that would be handled.
Yeah. I really like this idea of reframing it with Mother Gothel as, like, a truly benevolent figure. Not just a – you know, not just a morally gray character like maybe Mother from Zell, but truly like a good person who did something good for someone.
Yeah. And it's just this teenage idea of my mom is so unfair.
Yeah.
She won't let me hang out with the boy that I like because she thinks he's bad news, but he is bad news. You know, that kind of thing. And so I am interested in reframing the idea of who the villain in the story is in a modern context. So I've given some thought to that, but haven't gone full throttle into writing anything. It's just like bits and pieces of ideas at this point.
That's fun. I like it. I would read it, obviously.
Okay, cool.
All right. Well, I think that sums up Rapunzel.
I think so.
It's been fun.
It has. Please let us know, if you're listening, what your favorite Rapunzel retellings are that we may or may not have covered this month. Because as we've said, this might be a story that we revisit in the future. So we'd love to know what other versions of Rapunzel you'd like to see us talk about. And yeah, let's jump right in, feet first, into December's fairy tale, which is Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast. I think this is going to be a fun one. So let's start with a little bit of history, shall we?
Beauty and the Beast. Let's do it.
As they say, it is a tale as old as time.
Oh, Drew, you're killing me.
I didn't even plan that. That just came to me.
Just came to you. Brilliant.
It did. I didn't plan that. So listen, there is a long history of myths and folktales pairing up a human bride with an animal bridegroom.
Yes.
And it's something that's in, I mean, probably every culture, every language of tale. Like, it just happens a lot. And oftentimes that animal turns out to be human at the end. It goes back as far as like Cupid and Psyche, I think.
Yeah, mythology.
Is a big influence. Yeah. And what's interesting is that Beauty and Beast, as we know it, comes from a very specific point in time. It comes from a specific author, who is Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve, from 1740. It was when she published her short story, Beauty and the Beast, which is not short at all. It's very, 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 very long. Much longer than I expected it to be, because I don't think I've ever read her full original text before. I think I've only read abridged versions because her version was famously abridged in 1756, so just 16 years later, by another woman who was Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont, who wrote a much more condensed version of the story that is, frankly, a lot better.
It is. So Villeneuve's version of Beauty and the Beast, there are two prominent translations of it. There's a translation by a man named Dowson who stuck very close to her events, didn't change much, but it's a very literal translation, so it's not very lyrically written. And then there's another translator named Planche who translated the story in 1858, and he really worked to find like lyrical turns of phrases, mm-hmm. but he also edited the story for his Victorian audience.
Yes, so which you can imagine.
Yeah.
was quite repressed.
Yes, and so there are certain aspects and elements that are changed. And I was reminded as I was reading Villeneuve's followed by de Beaumont's of our discussion of Sleeping Beauty, mm-hmm. looking at the Perrault version of Sleeping Beauty versus the Grimm version of Sleeping Beauty, where Perrault had that whole extra ending about, and now I went off with my ogre stepmother and mm-hmm. other stuff happened. Because that's what the end of Villeneuve's story feels like.
Oh my gosh.
The transformation it's worse. Happens.
No, it's worse.
It is worse because it wouldn't stand on its own as a story. It no. is just like so much information and like you get a plot twist and you get a plot twist and you get a plot twist. And it's yeah. like I'm getting whiplash from reading the end of this. But if the only version of Beauty and the Beast that you're familiar with is the Disney movie, we should talk a little bit about the plot of these original stories.
Yeah, because it is a little different.
Significantly different yeah. from how Disney treated and adapted the story.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about Villeneuve's first because it came first. Mm-hmm. In her story, there is a merchant with 6 sons and 6 daughters.
Let me stop you right there. Okay. So 6 sons and 6 daughters. If you have any question in your mind about why Beauty is so willing to leave, it's because she comes from the cheaper by the dozen family. But they're also set in the world of Schitt's Creek, where they are extremely wealthy. And then the merchant loses all of his money and they have to go live in a tiny cottage in the woods. And everyone's upset because they've lost all of their luxury. And they're all horrible people. He literally calls them a wretched family, except for Beauty. So to me, I think it's very understandable why this youngest of 12 says, you know what? I'll go.
Yeah, I'm going to get out of here. 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. So yeah, her father is a merchant. They're very wealthy. They're very well-to-do. And then he runs into a series of misfortunes.
Yes.
Their house catches on fire. All of his ships get caught in like a tempest and sink to the bottom of the ocean. Foreign agents cheat him out of his money. He has to move to the country and they're abandoned by their friends and suitors. It's like, it doesn't rain, but it pours for this family. It's like not one thing happens. It's like you have the worst luck in the entire world.
They are literally the Rose family from Schitt's Creek, where they have to give up everything and everyone they've ever known abandons them. And they're stuck living in the middle of nowhere.
Except times 3, because yes. there's 13 of them. And I will correct you on one thing. They're not all horrible. Just the girls are horrible.
Oh, that's true. You're right.
So it says that, you know, the 6 sons are all like, well, let's make the best of this. And the youngest daughter's like, yeah, let's make the best of this. And then the other 5 girls are absolutely wretched.
Yep.
They're jealous of the youngest because she's the most beautiful. And they're angry with her because instead of complaining all the time like they do, she's like, let's learn how to plow and plant a garden. And they think that she's just showing off to be, like, impressive. And they resent her for her attitude, basically.
Yeah, well, and the text that I read, the translation, said that Beauty has a strength of mind which is not common in her sex. So I don't know if that's from the male translator or if that's from the original French version that was written by a woman. In which case, I assume that there's, like, internalized misogyny happening there. But, man, they are not nice to women in this story.
They're not.
Beauty is the only woman that is, like, considered good.
And here's the thing. Here's the other problem with it. They tell us a lot in this story that Beauty is smart. but they don't really show us that in the way that she acts through the whole story. Like, there are several points where they're like, oh, look, see, Beauty was intelligent. Oh, look, see, Beauty is shrewd. And I'm like, but she's not.
Because it's so obvious what's happening.
She doesn't figure out the most obvious thing. We'll get there.
So anyway, 2 years pass and there's a ship that returns. And so the merchant has to go to back to the city to go greet this ship to see if there's anything that's salvageable.
Yeah, because if he doesn't, his partners might get there first. Yes. And they might steal any profit.
Yes.
And not be honest with him about it. And all of her sisters, all of Beauty's sisters are like, bring us back gowns, bring us back gold, bring us back jewels, mm-hmm. because they're all assuming we're going to go right back to the status that we left.
Right. And the father asks Beauty, what would you like me to bring you? And Beauty says, just return safely. That's all I want. And he insists, it says he begs her because he's so enchanted by this answer.
And the sisters.
No, the sisters are livid.
Basically, like the way that I read it is Beauty goes, just your safe return, father. And all the sisters in the background going, just your safe return, father. Because that's how they treat her through the whole thing. Like as soon as she says that, they're like, well, look at her trying to suck up to dad over there. And so eventually she says, okay, fine. If you insist that I ask for something, bring me a rose.
Yeah. We don't have roses here. I love roses. Just bring me a rose. And so father goes back to the city. All of his partners have beat him there and he has nothing. He spends like 6 months trying to make this trip worthwhile by interacting with his old partners.
And basically the trip just ends up paying for itself.
Yeah.
In the end. Like, he doesn't lose any money, but he also doesn't gain any money in the end. And on his way home, he gets lost in the woods and ends up finding this enchanted castle.
Ooh.
Ooh. There's, like, a horrible snowstorm that he gets caught in. So he's looking for shelter. He finds this castle. Nobody is there. So he's wandering around the whole castle, like, going into every room trying to find who owns it. So that he can ask for shelter for the night and not just, like, take advantage. But he can't find anybody.
Yep.
So he eventually, like, finds a room to sleep in. And there's all this food that's provided. Mm-hmm. And he's not going to eat it at first unless he can find somebody. But he can't. So he finally does eat it. And he just verbally, he says to whoever is providing this, you know, thank you. You're saving my life. I appreciate your hospitality. Like, waiting for a response that just doesn't come. He doesn't get one.
Yeah, and he actually gets to the point where he believes that the castle has been magically presented to him. And so he starts, like, planning out, oh, this is going to be my oldest daughter's quarters, and this is going to be my son's apartments over here. And he starts planning out in his mind because he believes that the castle has actually been given to him.
And on the one hand, it's kind of presumptuous. But on the other hand, she does enough description of this that I can kind of get where he's coming from because he's searched the entire castle. He's like yelling and calling for somebody. He's getting no response. There's magically food on the table that's always warm. Like at some point I'd be like, maybe this is mine. Maybe this is a present for me. Is that right?
I think it's a bit of a stretch.
But
you know, he's a character in a fairy tale, so we can't expect him to be the smartest of people. So he eventually is about to leave, and as he leaves, there are roses in the garden, and so he says, "Oh, let me pluck a rose for Beauty." And as he does that, a beast appears
and threatens him with death.
Yes, he literally says that he's going to die. Because he's returned his generosity with thievery.
Yeah, he's like, did I not give you enough stuff? Like, I gave you all this food, I gave you a place to sleep, and now you're stealing my roses? And again, okay, but also, like, hey, beast.
It's a single flower.
Seems like a major escalation.
Noteworthy that these are not enchanted roses. There's nothing magical about them. There's no part of the curse that's, like, linked to it that puts him in danger for taking a rose. Nope, nothing like that. He just literally takes a flower from the garden.
One rose of, like, hundreds.
Yes. Yeah.
And the beast is like, nope, gonna kill you for that.
Yeah, you know, it'd be like that sometimes. But the merchant explains himself to the beast, and the beast is actually compelled because he tells his full story. He tells the whole long bit about We lost all our fortune. We had to move to the countryside. I thought I got my money back, but I didn't get anything back. So the beast says that he may go home, and in a month he must return. Or one of his daughters can come replace him.
And it's worth noting at this point that the beast continues to be generous to the merchant. Like, he says, you can't leave now because it's getting late, so stay another night, houses him, feeds him, and in the morning he's like, hey, pack anything you want in these trunks to take home with you. Like, anything in my palace that you want in these trunks, you can take it home with you. And it's like, okay, really, what is the deal with these roses? Because, like, you're loading him up with riches and jewels and gowns, but a rose.
But not the rose.
Yeah. But not the rose.
Also worth noting that the beast specifically says that the daughter that replaces him, if a daughter replaces him, she must be willing and she must be knowledgeable about the situation. Because the father says, like, under what pretext will I ever be able to convince one of my daughters to come here? And the beast says there can be no pretext. She has to know the true situation. You cannot trick one of your daughters. She must be willing.
Throughout this whole story, one of the things that I will say it has going for it is that this question of consent comes up again and again and again. Mm-hmm. The beast will not do anything without consent.
Yes. Even when Beauty eventually comes to the castle, the beast, like, makes this big show of saying, like, are you here willingly? And she must confirm that before he will accept her as, you know, the replacement for her father.
Now, we can quibble about how much willing consent can there really be when the alternative is your father's going to get killed.
Fair. Fair.
But at least the emphasis is there, and it's there throughout the story. This idea of, unless you agree to it, I will not press the issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On this question, on many questions. So yeah. I do appreciate that. But he goes back home, and on the ride, he's like, I'm not going to tell them anything. I'm going to keep the secret. I'm going to bring the riches home. I'm going to tell them they're all taken care of. And that's going to be that. And then he immediately gets home and he's like, this is everything that happened to me. It's like, dude.
And of course, Beauty is the one who is willing to go to replace her father.
All the sons are.
Oh, yes. But
all the sons say, hey, we'll go. We'll take your place.
And they also threaten to, like, go find and kill the beast. But
right.
The father is very clear that, like, that's not really an option. Like, that wouldn't work.
Yeah. And so Beauty is the only girl, of course.
Yeah.
Who's like, I asked for the rose. This is my fault. I will go and I will rectify this. Father tries to dissuade her. She will not be dissuaded. They go back to the palace. She asserts her willingness again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Like, over and over. She swears, I am here of my own free will. I know what I'm getting into. Well, I understand the circumstances.
She also believes that she's going to die. Like, in Disney's Beauty and the Beast, she is giving her life for her father's to be prisoner, right? The whole way there in the fairy tale, Beauty is under the assumption that she is going to her death, that the beast is just going to kill her. So it's a very different thing that she's consenting to.
It's true. It's true. Again, though, the beast provides generously. He says, once again, fill all these trunks. Father can take it home with him. And so here is another moment where we're told, like, look how shrewd and intelligent Beauty is, because she tells her father, hey, maybe fill some of these with gold, but don't tell my sisters that you have this much gold.
Yeah.
Because they'll spend right through it. Yeah. Like, maybe tell them you have one trunk of gold. Maybe don't tell them you have five trunks of gold.
Yeah. Which is smart, because they're a little greedy, those five sisters.
Bit.
Yeah. And so her father leaves. She takes a nap. And while napping, she has a dream.
Oh, Beauty's dreams. Oh, Beauty's dreams.
These dreams are an integral part of the story moving forward. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. So she encounters two people in these dreams.
Yes.
Consistently. She encounters a fairy
mm-hmm.
who always tells her, be strong, be brave, you're doing the right thing, keep on fighting, keep on living your life.
And
she dreams of this handsome prince who she refers to as her beloved unknown.
Her unknown, yes.
And he comes before her and he tells her in the dream, he's like, I love you. I am in love with you and you have to save me. Judge not by thine eyes, but release me from my prison. And he won't tell her any more than that.
Over and over, he says, release me from my prison. So initially, Beauty's first thought, I don't think is totally off the wall, which is she thinks that the young man in the dream is another captive of the beast. So she thinks that she needs to explore the castle and find him to literally set him free from a prison, which, you know, okay. That's not that bad. That's not crazy. I'm with you there.
Yeah, except that on her exploration of the castle, she finds a portrait of this handsome young man.
This is like immediate. Like she wakes up from the nap, goes to explore the castle, and immediately finds this portrait of the same boy from her dream.
Yeah. She's like, oh gosh, that's weird.
What a coincidence.
Who could it be? This is so strange. Why would the beast have a portrait of this handsome man from my dream?
Needless to say, she does not figure it out. She ends up at dinner with the beast.
No. The beast comes to her once a day.
Yes.
He comes to her chamber to have dinner with her, and every time he's there, he asks her one question. And the question depends on which translation you're reading.
Yes.
If you're reading Villeneuve or Dawson's translation of Villeneuve, the question is, will you sleep with me?
Right.
And if you're reading the Puritan translation, it's, will you marry me?
Right. Yeah.
Now, I think it's really interesting. I don't know when sleep with me, the colloquialism, came to mean sex. Because here's the thing. We talked earlier about these animal bridegroom tales, one of which is Cupid and Psyche, one of which is a Norwegian story called East of the Sun, West of the Moon. Mm-hmm. And in both of those stories, part of the curse that's laid on the enchanted man is that a woman must sleep beside him in a bed every night for a year without once seeing his face. And it's not a sexual thing. It's literally just she has to be like willing to sleep beside you.
Yes.
Every night for a year. And so, like I said, I would have to do some etymology work to find out when that phrase became colloquial to mean have sex with me. Because I'm not sure that that's what Villeneuve intended.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to find out. But, you know, for the Victorians, just sleeping together in the same bed, if you're not married, that's going to be scandalous enough.
Of course. Well, I think this is interesting when connected with our Sleeping Beauty story as well.
Mm-hmm.
But especially here with what you're saying, where maybe she literally meant sleep beside me.
Yeah.
And it was the English translation that took that to mean to have sex. That's very interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know which one is accurate. I honestly don't. But regardless, whatever the question is, Beauty's response is no. And she's afraid when she has to say no that she's going to anger the beast and he's going to be upset and he might hurt her. But as soon as she says no, he goes, okay.
When she first hesitates, he tells her, just be direct. And then she says no. And he immediately says, okay, he accepts that answer, and then he leaves for the night. And he continues to do this at every dinner that they have together.
Every dinner, he asks the same question. And it gets to the point where they were told that Beauty and the Beast become friends.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really shown that. We're just kind of told that it happens.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes sense if you're having dinner with the same person every night.
Yeah.
It makes sense that you'd become friends, but...
Yeah. We're also told that she gets distressed that he asks this question every single night when her answer always has to be no. And it starts to get upsetting for her, understandably.
Yeah, yeah. And at the same time, she's continuing to have dreams of this human man every night, and she's falling in love with this human. So she's, you know, why would she say yes to marrying the Beast when she's falling in love with this other person. And she tells the young man about the question that the Beast asks her every dinner. And the young man says, "Love him who loves you. Do not be misled by appearances and release me from prison." So
he's not helpful at all.
Not helpful. He's telling her to marry the Beast.
Yeah.
And she's distressed by this. Like, she still doesn't want to do it.
Yeah. And her life in the palace is kind of marvelous. Like, she has only to say out loud something that she wants, and it appears before her. There are these magical windows that will show her anywhere in the world. So she can literally, mm-hmm. like, go sit in front of a window and watch an opera if she wants to. Like, yeah. Let me tell you, that would be a charmed life. Do you know how many Broadway shows I would watch with a magic window?
Oh my gosh.
Like, I would like to see the original cast of Wicked, please and thank you. Awesome. Here it is in front of me.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So, like, her life is idyllic in this castle. But here's the problem that I have.
Okay.
So if you go up to a random person on the street and you say, "Hey, you, what's the message of Beauty and the Beast?" You will be told, love doesn't care about appearances, and what's on the inside matters more than what's on the outside. That is a great message.
Yeah.
That's not the message of this one. Because the reason she isn't in love with the Beast is because she's in love with the handsome dude. Yes. And that's it's literally expressed that way. Like, it's said at more than one point, why would she love someone as ugly as the Beast when she could love the handsome man from her dreams? And I'm
You're absolutely right.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
That's not the message that this story is supposed to give me.
And eventually...
Beauty becomes homesick.
Of course.
Because her family thinks that she's dead. And she becomes really fixated on this idea that her father in particular, like, believes that she's been killed. And she really wants to let him know that she's still alive, that her life is good, and that she's not, you know, a horrible prisoner. And so she asks the Beast, "Hey, can I go visit my family?" And his response is basically, "I can deny you nothing, but it will kill me if you leave."
Yeah.
Which is mostly just him being melodramatic, as it turns out.
Is it?
Yes.
I mean, when she comes back, he's like literally dying.
Yeah, because he laid down on the ground and refused to eat because he was pining away for her. Like, as soon as she splashes some water on his face and she's like, "Hey, I'm not going anywhere and I'll marry you." He's like, "Oh, I feel much better."
So I guess when we get to the de Beaumont version, it's not as dramatic. He's being much more literal there. But here in this version, you're right, he's just
throwing
a whiny
fit.
Baby.
Like, he's being a whiny baby. Yeah. Eventually he agrees, and she says, "Give me 2 months and then I will come back and I will stay with you forever." Mm-hmm. And so he makes her promise you will come back in 2 months.
Yes. Yes. And she does.
And so she swears. As soon as she's home, all of her sisters have suitors now because the family is rich again. And as soon as they take one look at Beauty, all of her sister's suitors abandon them and are now pursuing Beauty.
Ugh.
Which is uncomfy.
Yeah, that's an awkward situation.
But in this one, in the Villeneuve version, it's her brothers and her father who delay her promised return. They're the ones who say, like, "Don't go back yet. Don't go back yet. Don't go back yet.
Yeah.
Just stay with us. What's the worst that could happen?" And she's kind of indignant about it. She's like, "I promised that I would go back."
Yes. There's a big deal made about her honor and that she's an honorable person. She's a woman of her word. So she stays just an extra day, right? Just one extra day?
It's a little worse than that. She has a dream where the fairy appears and tells her,
"Oh, yes.
Hey, you are out of time. Your Beast is dying. He will die if you don't return. You need to get back to the palace." She wakes up and goes, "Oh, gosh, I need to get back to the palace." And then proceeds to stay at her house for another day.
Yeah.
But she knows that the Beast is dying. She's like, "I have to get back." And then still stays.
Yeah.
A whole nother day. And then when she does make her way back to the palace, She goes to her room and sits and waits for the beast to show up.
She's also, like, but she had a dream that he was like laying in the garden canal dying. And so she gets back to the castle. And like you said, she just goes to her room and
she goes to her room,
takes another nap. And her handsome prince doesn't appear to her in her dream. And then she's like, let me just go watch another opera and spend the day. And then she says, maybe she should go check the garden. Let's just go check it out. And but then she finds the beast laying face
down.
Tell
me again how smart this girl is.
Yeah.
Tell me how honorable she is. Tell me how much she cares about her friend the beast. Because I'm not getting that.
Yeah. But the thing is that it's, they tell us over and over how honorable she is, how much she cares for her friendship, blah, yeah, blah, 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 how smart she is. But then it's never evident.
Yeah. Show don't tell.
No, not at all.
Show don't tell. So she eventually finds him. And as soon as she sees him dying in a cave, she's like, oh, no, I do actually love you. Hey, I'll marry you. Please wake up. Let me go dump some water on your head. And so he wakes up. And it's not her saying she loves him that breaks the curse. It's not her agreeing to marry him that breaks the curse. It's actually getting married.
Well, first he wakes up. Then she takes another nap. And then in the nap, the young man tells her to marry the beast. And then she has another dinner with the beast and agrees to marry him. And that's when the fairy and the prince's mother, the queen, arrive.
Yeah, so he's transformed back into a human.
So, yeah, but that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen when he's, like, dying.
No.
He's dying, and then she takes a nap.
It's 2 days later.
They have dinner. She agrees to marry him. And then this fairy shows up.
And then the story's not done. We're barely halfway through it. And we're not going to get super in-depth into the back half of this because...
I can't do it.
Nobody does the back half of this story.
So let's real quick.
Really fast.
Real quick.
The prince's mother shows up. She's like, yay, you freed my son. I'm so happy that you freed my son. I'm glad my son's marrying a princess. And Beauty's like, I'm not a princess. And the queen's like, oh, that's a problem. You need to be a princess.
Right.
And then the fairy's like, actually, she is a princess.
Oh my gosh.
I took her from her father, the king, who lives in the next kingdom over, and gave her to this merchant for some reason. It's never been mentioned before, but I promise it's true. And then we also get the backstory of how the prince got cursed, which is awful.
It's so much. There's so much happening here.
There's so much. It was a fairy, a different fairy who raised him as his nursemaid, but then decided she wanted to marry him. And so when she said that, he was rightfully like, no, that's gross.
Yes.
And then she's like, okay, well, then you get to be a beast forever.
Yeah.
And unless you can find a young maiden who will agree to marry you despite what you look like, and you can't tell her anything about who you are, or you'll be a beast forever. And your mother can't tell anybody that you're her son, or you'll be a beast forever.
It's so messy. There's just so much extra stuff here that you're at the end of the story and you're like, maybe if you had told me all of this during the rest of the story, I would have been interested. But I'm now at the end. Like...
Yeah.
I'm not invested anymore.
And it's like just sitting and having characters talk at you.
Yes.
Like, if this scene is important enough to be in your story, then it's important enough to just be a scene in its own right.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be. And now let me sit down and tell you all about this thing that happened to me.
Yeah, it's a very strange choice.
It's very strange. It's hard to read. And we're not going to touch on it much because it's kind of irrelevant.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because when people adapt Beauty and the Beast, they may use this, but if they use it, they're not going to use it here. They're going to develop the backstory as they see fit. No one makes Beauty a princess. That's not a thing that anyone
uses. That's never happened. You know why? Because it's dumb.
No, yeah. And then the Beast's backstory, I mean, some people may use seeds of this, but I think that's just because, you know, jealous, rejected lover is a common trope for a villain, especially a female villain, unfortunately, even though it's way more interesting as a male villain. And so, yeah, people aren't going to use it. But in the end, they get married and they live happily ever after.
Yeah, I guess. So when De Beaumont adapted this, she took out the weird ending, mm-hmm. and really just tightened and condensed everything. And she took out the stuff that doesn't make sense. And I applaud her for that.
It's probably 5% of the original story. It is so much shorter and smarter because of it.
Yeah. So there's three sons and three daughters in mm-hmm. this one. So we cut the family in half. Mm-hmm. Everything else follows pretty much exactly as Villeneuve's until the merchant gets to the house. The palace finds it in the woods. He does not assume that the house is there for him, but he does assume that it has been provided by a good fairy for his use.
Yes.
While he's there, still plucks the rose. All that's the same. But when Beauty gets to the palace, she still dreams, but she only dreams of the fairy.
Yes, exactly.
There's no handsome unknown mm-hmm. in this version that she falls in love with in a dream.
Thank goodness.
He's not there. He's not a character. This version introduces the library mm-hmm. in the palace that has become such a fixture in retellings.
Yes. It's hard to imagine Beauty and the Beast without a grand library.
Yes. So this one introduces the library. It also introduces the magic mirror.
Yes.
That will show her. Well, that's kind of in Villeneuve's too with the magic windows.
Yeah.
But this one's a little bit more. It's a mirror specifically. In this version, she asks to return home because her father is ill.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to go make sure he's okay.
Yes. And when she gets there, her sisters are married. So it's said that one of them is married to a man who is very handsome, but very vain. And the other is married to a man who's very clever and witty, but he's annoying because of that. And so ultimately, at the end, the fairy commends Beauty for choosing the Beast, not for his handsome looks and not for his intelligent mind, but for his goodness of character. So we are starting to get that theme of it's what's inside that really counts.
Yes. And so that's more prominent here. I also appreciate in this version, she only asks to go home for a week mm-hmm. and the Beast is willing to send her home forever.
Yeah.
Like as soon as she asks to go home, like my father is sick, can I go see him for a week? The Beast is like, you can go home forever. You never have to return. I will die without you. But you are under no obligation to return to
Yes. me. And when he says, I will die without you, it's literal. So
it's actual.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
When she comes back, he is literally dying. And in that moment, when she's there, that's when he transforms back into his human state, which is just a much better, like, dramatic climax to the story.
It is.
That's the moment.
And in this one, she has a magic ring that will return her home as soon as she's ready.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her sisters who plot to detain her.
Yes. Yes.
The sisters are actually, like, even worse in this one than they are in Villeneuve's.
They There's are.
Thing about, like, they, like, rub onions in their eyes to make themselves cry when she's leaving.
Yes. Yeah. They totally fake it. I feel like the father and the brothers, they wanted to keep Beauty because they love her so much. Is that right? In the Villeneuve?
Yes.
Yes. And the sisters here, they want to keep Beauty behind.
They're upset that she's happy.
Yes.
And they're not happy.
Exactly.
So they're in these marriages and they're not happy. Their sister is happy. And that's upsetting to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this one, she stays home for 10 days instead of a week. And then she has the dream that her delayed return is detrimental to the Beast. And she realizes she loves him. And she goes straight back and finds him and agrees to marry him, and he transforms back. And mm-hmm. so it is Villeneuve's story, but it is streamlined and condensed, and all the like extemporaneous fluff is taken out, and it's kind of honed down to its bare essentials, and it's a stronger story because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. So now that we have gone through the tale of Beauty and the Beast, let's talk about the criteria that we're going to be looking at as we look at our adaptations of Beauty and the Beast this month.
Yeah. So this month we have four pieces of criteria that mm-hmm. we are going to be looking at. And we really are going to be comparing the Beauty and the Beast story to the de Beaumont version mostly.
Yeah.
Our first piece of criteria is we want a stronger, more capable protagonist in Beauty. And I personally really want that to include a stronger reason for why she doesn't come back to the castle when she says she's going to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy that she just loses track of time.
Yeah. I mean, especially for a character who we're told over and over is so smart. It seems strange for her to lose track of the time a little bit there.
Yeah. So I want there to be more of something preventing her from getting back on time. It's also going to make the stakes higher in the story, which is only an improvement.
Yes, true. Our second piece of criteria is a backstory for the prince and why is he cursed? Technically, the original Villeneuve version does give us that, but it's tacked on at the end. It feels uncompelling, I guess. So we want this to be incorporated into the story itself.
Yeah, and de Beaumont doesn't really give us a reason at all.
No,
it's kind of very vaguely stated. Yeah, I did something and got cursed, but we're never told what happened.
Yeah.
And I think you can really tie the reason for the curse into the story in a really strong way. It's easy. It's such an easy thing to do with this one.
For me, if a retelling of Beauty and the Beast isn't telling us why the beast is a beast, I don't want it.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Criteria 3. I want the relationship between Beauty and the Beast to be built up more. So we're told that they become friends, but we're not really shown that they become friends. Yeah. We're not shown why Beauty falls in love with him, and I want to be. So it's understandable. I think you can read between the lines on the Beast's end that Beauty is like the one who can break his curse. And so that's, of course, why he wants this relationship. But I want to see Beauty come to consider him a friend. I want to see that relationship progress through all of its stages.
Mm-hmm. And then our fourth criteria is that we would like to see a stronger message, because especially the Villeneuve version tries to give you a message that, you know, beauty comes in many forms, beauty comes from within, that kind of thing. And it really, really epically fails. And so we would really like the adaptations to fix that. Whatever the message is, it needs to be there and it needs to tell its message through its story.
So our lineup for the month, we will be reading Beauty by Robin McKinley, because of course we are.
Yeah, this is kind of the OG. Oh, we said that at the same time. Jinx.
We did.
Yeah, it's kind of the OG fairy tale adaptation.
And if I have time, I'm going to try and reread Rose Daughter, also by Robin McKinley, to do a comparison between the two. But we'll see how much time I have to read. And Drew said I cannot make him read two Robin McKinleys in 1 month.
I can't do it. I'll do one, but I can't do two back to back.
So I'm going to take the second one on myself. We'll see if it happens.
Okay, sounds good.
Then we are going to be watching the 1987 movie Beauty and the Beast, directed by Eugene Marner, with John Savage as the Beast. It is a wonderful piece of cinema.
Wonderful is not the word that you use with me when you were describing this movie before. So I am very interested to watch this. After that, we will be looking at Beastly by Alex Flynn. So that'll be our first modern adaptation that we've looked at for any of our fairy tales so far. So that will be a fun one. And then that will be followed by Beast by Donna Jo Napoli. So our second Napoli book as well.
And of course, at the end of the month, we will be looking at all things Disney with Beauty and the Beast. So the animated movie, the live action movie, and you best believe I'm talking about the Broadway musical.
And on top of that, I don't know if I've mentioned it on this podcast so far, but I worked for 2.5 years at Be Our Guest Restaurant at Magic Kingdom in Orlando, Florida. So I literally worked within the world of Beauty and the Beast for 2.5 years. So I have some things to say about the theme parks as well.
So I think you can probably anticipate that that one will be another jam-packed, super long episode.
That could be our longest episode so far, maybe ever. We've got a lot to talk about.
It's true. So we're really excited to get to Beauty and the Beast. Hope that you are too. Please feel free to read and watch along with us. The 1987 Beauty and the Beast movie is available for free to watch on YouTube.
Yes.
So that's where you can find that. And the rest, go patronize your local library.
Absolutely. We encourage that. If you want to chat with us about anything related to our Rapunzel month or anything upcoming here in our Beauty and the Beast month, you can find us on Facebook or Instagram by searching Of Slippers and Spindles. You can email us. We're just ofslippersandspindles@gmail.com. And we're really excited for Beauty and the Beast month. We'll end the year strong.
Absolutely. We will see you in December. And we will talk to y'all later.
See you on Wednesday.